This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Bob McDonald. Welcome to Quirks and Quarks. On this week's show, a new discovery gives a young Canadian researcher gold fever.
Dude, I made a scene. I flipped the chair over when I got up. And he's looking at me like, who's this guy beating up my laboratory?
And Stone Age teenagers hit that awkward... awkward age.
Adolescents today are just following a blueprint for puberty that was set in motion thousands and thousands of years ago.
Plus, why sharks are abandoning their homes on coral reefs, how our galaxy witnessed a supermassive black hole collision in its youth, and a Canadian astronaut gives us a bird's eye view of migration. All this today on Quirks and Quarks. I have one word for you. Gold.
These are the two biggest specimens they've found so far. This one's 90 kilograms and this one's 60 kilograms.
Yeah, there was just gold everywhere, as far as you could see.
Humans have been obsessed with gold since prehistory. We know it's been mined for more than 6,000 years. And the lust for gold has created and toppled empires and cost uncounted lives to greed and madness. And part of that is because gold is unusual as a naturally occurring pure element. Most metals appear in nature chemically bound to other things. But gold is different. Quite often we find it in nuggets or pure veins associated with the crystal mineral quartz, and often in places plagued by earthquakes. Now a Canadian scientist in Australia thinks he knows why. Dr. Chris Boise is a geology research fellow at Monash University in Melbourne. Hello, Dr. Boise. Welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now, before we get into your finding, describe these rocky quartz veins and why the origin of gold chunks inside them was such a mystery.
All right. Yeah. So, like you said, a lot of people know that gold is found in quartz veins. But one of the things that we've been trying to get a handle on is how you can take large quantities of gold and concentrate them into a nugget is something that was still a bit of an outstanding mystery.
Well, what was it about the quartz that you thought might have something to do with the formation of gold nuggets inside?
Well, the quartz is actually really peculiar in that it has an effect called the piezoelectric effect, which is when a material is stressed or strained or deformed, it can generate a voltage. So people are actually pretty familiar with this, whether they know it or not. This is how barbecue lighters work, for example. When you click a barbecue lighter, that click sound that you hear is a hammer hitting a piezoelectric crystal, and that generates a voltage, which makes a spark, and then the gas flows through the spark, and it ignites.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. I know some microphones work that way as well. The sound vibrations make a crystal go.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay, so quartz will do that naturally. What did you suspect was happening to create solid gold in these piezoelectric quartz veins?
Well, it kind of worked out a bit too conveniently. So as you mentioned, a lot of these gold nuggets are associated with quartz veins formed during earthquakes, which means that they formed during, you know, violent rattling of Earth's crust. And considering quartz is piezoelectric, and it's actually one of the very few piezoelectric minerals on the planet, and this thing happens to host all the big gold nuggets, it started to sort of add up that, you know, the veins are made of quartz, they form during violent earthquake action, they're going to get rattled around. So will they generate a voltage? And is this voltage appropriate for basically forming gold nuggets? That was the question we had.
Oh, I see. During earthquakes, you get sort of lightning effects, electric activity inside the quartz that could affect the gold.
Yeah, absolutely. We know that, for example, in industry, people use electric plating for materials. So they might gold plate, you know, a microchip or whatever material. And they do that by hooking up whatever metal they want to coat to a battery. And if quartz can generate a voltage and behave a bit like a battery, then we're thinking, hey, could we stick gold onto quartz naturally, almost like we're trying to gold plate a material, but, you know, have the earthquake do the work and have the quartz do the work for us.
So how did you test that out?
So I went to a crystal healing shop down the road where they sell nice quartz crystals. Okay. I was doing it for science. I wasn't doing it for, spiritual alignment or anything. But I took this quartz crystal and I submerged it into a gold-bearing solution that I made in a laboratory. And then I had a linear motor, which is almost like an automatic hammer, if you like. Like, picture something a bit like a jackhammer. And I smacked the quartz crystal for about an hour when it was submerged in this gold-bearing solution. And afterwards, I looked at it under an electron microscope to see if any gold had precipitated on it. And it did.
What did you actually see?
I seen a bunch of little gold nuggets on the quartz surface. It was really, really great.
What was your reaction to that?
I made a scene. there's a technician operating the electron microscope, and I flipped the chair over when I caught up. And he's looking at me like, who's this guy beating up my laboratory? but I think when I explained to him like sort of what was going on and why this was important, he shared in my enthusiasm a bit more. But at the time, yeah, it might have been an overreaction.
You got a bit of the old prospector's gold fever. There's gold in them, there are quartz hills.
yeah, there's super small gold in that there's sample I prepared. I was pretty excited.
Okay, so you created these little gold specks by hitting the quartz. How does this explain how the gold actually forms that way, how it comes in out of the quartz into the nuggets?
Oh, okay, yeah. So the way these veins form in nature is that during an earthquake, the earth's crust, you know, fractures, it faults, you know, breaks open. And then fluids from really deep in the earth, so maybe, you know, 10 to 15 kilometers depth, there's actually what we call metamorphic fluids. They're almost like hot rock sweat, if you like. So when rocks get really deep, they get under pressure, they get heated, and any water that's in the rock will come out. And that water is what's responsible for making these gold deposits. So the idea is that when the fracture breaks open, and then the fluids come from really deep to a bit more shallow in the earth's crust, they have gold dissolved in them. Not a lot, only about one part per million, let's say. But that gold is dissolved. It's dissolved into this water. So in order to form a gold nugget or to form any gold at all, you need to find a way to get the gold out of the solution and to precipitate as a solid. So we suggest that quartz donates an electron, which basically pulls the gold out of the dissolved solution and precipitates it in as a solid form.
Oh, I see. That piezoelectric effect from the stress of the quartz, the electricity causes the gold to come out. But how does it grow into a nugget?
Okay, yeah. So this is sort of our second result. And this second result is probably even more exciting than the first one. We actually had a natural quartz vein from a gold mine that already had a little bit of gold in it. And we did the same experiment with this thing. So, you know, we submerged it in solution. We hit it with our little hammer for an hour. But what we've seen there as a result was that all the gold that precipitated from the solution went directly onto the pre-existing gold. So rather than make a bunch of little gold nuggets or start coating the quartz or anything like that, we actually started to grow on the pre-existing gold. So this actually makes a lot of sense in hindsight, because quartz is an insulator, gold is a conductor. So when you're going to generate a voltage and you're going to try to move electrons through the system, the gold's actually going to do all the heavy lifting. It's conductive. It will happily move electrons around. So that becomes a bit of a lightning rod for further gold reactions. So any gold that's dissolved in a fluid that's around the quartz, it's going to basically hone in onto the pre-existing gold, because that's donating all the electrons. It really pushes this reaction forward.
So the gold is attracted to gold.
Yeah. I said earlier about the industry gold plating thing. We're basically gold plating gold. That's exactly what we ended up doing.
Wow. Well, now that you've figured this process out, could it be used to help us locate new gold mines?
Unfortunately, I don't think so. Oh. This is a pretty blue skies bit of science. But that being said, there was a technique that was being used by a lot of Russian scientists called seismokinetic exploration. And what they could do was they could map the voltages that they were detecting from depth. And this highlighted where quartz veins were. But it won't tell you if those quartz veins have gold in them or not.
Okay, so in Ontario, there are some quartz mountains in Killarney National Park. You can see them from a distance. They're white. And I'm just wondering if I should go there with a hammer and just start pounding on the ground and see what happens.
I mean, you'll probably generate sparks. You'll generate a bit of heat as well. But, I mean, the problem is gold's got to come from somewhere, right? So, you know, in my lab, people get excited because they're like, oh, my God, this guy's, like, printing money. It's like, no, I had to pay, you know, hundreds of dollars for gold to dissolve into a fluid to then just put it back onto something else. Unfortunately, I'm not printing money, but I do get to do cool science.
Cool indeed. Dr. Boise, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Chris Boise is a research fellow in the School of Earth, Atmosphere and Environment at Monash University in Melbourne, Australia. Puberty. The voice cracking, growth spurts, acne, first menstruation, it's not known for being a fun time in life. But in some ways, hitting these awkward developmental milestones can connect us to one another. After all, we've all gone through it at some point. Well, it turns out that's true going back many, many, many years. A new analysis of the bones of teenagers from the Ice Age, 25,000 years ago, shows they experienced puberty much the same way as teens today. Dr. April Noel is a Paleolithic archaeologist and professor of anthropology at the University of Victoria. Hi, and welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for having me.
What got you interested in studying Ice Age teenagers?
Well, I guess it was really my kids. When they were little, I started studying the evolution of play behavior. And then as they grew into teens, and I started to have my kitchen flooded with these people who are eating me out of house and home, I started to become a lot more interested in adolescence.
Well, before your study, what did we know about teenagers 25,000 years ago?
Honestly, we knew virtually nothing about them. I think it's because when we think about children versus adults, that's pretty simple. We know when we have a child's skeleton, it's pretty unambiguous. But for a lot of people, adolescence is really this kind of liminal stage. You know, when does a child become an adult? But adolescence is actually also a biological stage in human development. So that's how we approached it. We looked at adolescence from a biological point of view, and there are a lot of really good markers, puberty being one of them, that helps us identify adolescence in the fossil record.
Well, how did you find Ice Age teenage bones to even study?
We went through the literature and just looked for skeletons that were dated to the right period, so between 12,000 and around 40,000 years ago in Europe, and ones that were complete enough that would have the right skeletal elements that we needed to study in order to infer a puberty stage. And of all the skeletons we looked at, we came up with 13 individuals.
How are you able to learn about puberty stages just using these old bones?
Well, that's the exciting part about this. So Mary Lewis, my colleague in this project, had developed this amazing technique based on clinical data, based on clinical observations. So in a clinical setting, you can look at different stages of maturation. There are six stages of puberty, and you can look at the changes in the skeleton that go along with each of these stages. So Mary took that information and modified it to be able to apply it to archaeological populations.
Well, what are some of the markers that you looked at?
So there are characteristic changes that happen in the hand, the wrist, the elbow, the neck, and the pelvis.
So what, you see growth spurts kind of thing? The bones get longer?
Well, some of them change shape a little bit. And in other cases, we have fusion of the long bones happening in very specific order. You can also look, for example, at mineralization of the canine. So we look at that, the root of the canine, and is that fully mineralized? And in the case in changes to the elbow, we know that's associated with stage three of puberty. And stage three is when what we call peak height velocity. So that's when teens are going through that real growth spurt where they seem to just shoot up overnight. And along with that, with these different stages come very specific changes on the outside of the body as well. So during stage three is when girls start to develop breasts and boys have that super awkward phase of their voice starting to break.
Oh, I remember it well.
I think we all do, or we all try and block it out. It never happened.
Your pants are too short.
That's right.
All of that. Yes.
And for us as girls, we're always like a head taller than everyone else in class for a long time. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Now, were you also able to tell from the bones things like muscle development, what their bodies look like?
Yeah, we were. And we saw that these adolescents were super active and they were using their right arms quite a bit. The kind of changes that you would see if people were actively involved in hunting or fishing, that kind of thing. And that was exciting for us because it really showed us that these teens were contributing to the overall security and well-being of their society by contributing economically.
Now, what about timing? Sometimes we hear about, kids today are maturing earlier because of hormones or food or whatever. What about these ice age kids? At what age were they reaching puberty?
Yeah, so that was a surprise for us in the sense that, there's this sense in you know, the popular imagination today that adolescents are entering puberty way earlier than ever before. But what we found is that our ice age teenagers are starting puberty just a little bit later than they are today. So kids today are starting around 9 to 13, and our ice age teens are roughly around 13, 13 and a half years old is when they're entering puberty. So the anxiety that parents have today, I would say, is unfounded because adolescents today are just following a blueprint for puberty that was set in motion thousands and thousands of years ago.
Wow. So what does that tell you about how they experience puberty?
Well, that's what's really interesting to me is that we not only took the data that we got about puberty, but we also enriched it by looking at the ethnographic records. So there's a lot of people who have been working with adolescents in hunter-gatherer societies. And I think in the West, we have this sense that teenagers are filled with angst. It's the plot line of every coming of age movie, right? I mean, that's what we think of when we think of adolescence. But when we look at how puberty is experienced, how teenagehood is experienced outside the industrialized West, we start to see that in these cases, teenagers are growing up in smaller groups, and there are these groups of mixed ages and mixed sexes. And so by the time children grow into adolescence, they know their place in the world. There's no sort of, how do I fit into this community? There's no, you know, angst and anxiety in the way that we think of as being synonymous with teenagers here. And some of the things that drive us crazy, like I remember when my son was a teenager, he would stay up late all night and sleep until 2 p.m, and it would drive me nuts. But now there are studies out there that show that there's an evolutionary benefit to having one member of your small group be awake at all times of the night. And so in this sense, the teens are taking the night shift. And so the more that we look to the past, we start to see that the things that we think of with teenagehood and some of the things that drive us crazy are actually maybe really beneficial for us and things that we should rethink.
After studying teenagehood from the Ice Age, how has this changed your impression of your own teenagers?
Well, you know, we made it through the teenagehood. We made it through the teenage years. They're now in their early 20s. But yeah, I think I would have been a little more sympathetic to them and a little more understanding. So maybe maybe our research can help other parents out there who think they'll never get through these years.
Kids today, just like kids from yesterday.
Exactly. Absolutely.
Dr. Noel, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. April Noel is a Paleolithic archaeologist and professor of anthropology at the University of Victoria. It's like rats leaving a sinking ship, except it's already underwater. And the rats are sharp-toothed super predators. Coral reefs, as we've talked about before, are under stress in many parts of the world, thanks to climate warming. Warm waters stress the corals and can cause damaging bleaching events that can devastate the reef's productivity. And in a new study, researchers studying reefs in the Indian Ocean are discovering that as reefs undergo stressful warming events, the endangered gray sharks that inhabit them are getting the heck out of Dodge, abandoning their preferred habitat. It's a new insight into how environmental stress can affect this ecosystem. Dr. Michael Williamson, a research scientist at the Zoological Society of London, led this study. Dr. Williamson, welcome to our program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
First of all, tell me a little bit about the gray reef sharks that live in the Indian Ocean.
Yeah, so they're kind of a medium-sized shark, as we say, so they can get up to usually around 2 meters long, but can get up to about 2.5. They inhabit lots of coral reef systems in the Pacific and the Indian Ocean. So they're kind of over two of the largest oceans of the world.
What role do they play on the reef?
They're really important as far as the coral reef ecosystem. So they're obviously predators. So they're what's known as central place foragers, where they are based on a coral reef. And then during the night, they'll disappear to go hunting. And then when they come back, they deposit lots of nutrients that they've been eating throughout the day through kind of fecal matter. So they're important for the ecosystem.
Well, how did you track the movements of these sharks for this study?
We used acoustic telemetry. So we have acoustic tags, which are a tag which is a couple of centimeters long that we surgically place into a shark's body cavity. We sew that up and that releases an acoustic signal. And then we have receivers around the coral reefs. And as a shark goes past one of these receivers, it releases an acoustic ping. And then the receiver detects that shark and it's come close. So it's a bit like a travel card system when you tap in. So I'm from London. We have the Oyster card. And as you tap in at, say, Victoria and then tap out again at King's Cross, you know the movements that going from Victoria to King's Cross, but not necessarily in between.
Wow. So you had to catch these sharks, do surgery on them, and then put them back on the reef.
Yeah, that's right. We fish with barbless hooks. So you go out in a boat and you in an area where you think, well, you hope there'll be sharks and fish for them. And the whole process is very quick. We pull the shark alongside. We do the surgery very quickly and release them. And it doesn't seem to cause too much damage to the sharks at all. And we've got data from these sharks for 8 years in this study. So animals have been regularly recorded for 8 years. So we can see that it doesn't do too much damage to them.
8 years? That's astounding. How many sharks did you tag?
In this study, on the grey reef sharks, we have 122 that were tagged in for this study.
So what did you see?
We saw that at this site in the Indian Ocean, which is the Chagos Archipelago, we noticed there were these big bleaching events following El Nino years when there was high temperature warming. And we were interested in seeing how this affected the shark's movement behavior. But what we found is as the environmental stress went up, their residency decreased, so they were spending less time on the reefs. The time between detections was getting bigger, and their space use increased as well. So it was really interesting to see how their behavior changed just from the changes in environmental conditions.
Now, was it just the warmer temperatures that were causing them to leave, or were there other factors involved as well?
There's multiple factors. It could be to do with temperature at this site. What we know is that there are a number of variables that cause the coral reef stress. They're particularly impacted by current and lack of wind, which could exacerbate higher temperature. It's hard to say why exactly that this is happening, but what we think is that something like a sea temperature will be going up, which will cause the sharks to move away, possibly into cooler waters, because they will behavioral thermoregulate. So they're ectotherms. So if the water temperature gets too hot, they'll get too hot. So they move offshore. But then what might be happening is they're staying away for up to 16 months. And that's probably because the environment is being damaged. Their prey might be leaving. The reefs aren't as good as quality. So they're staying away and trying to visit lots of different reefs in the area.
So where are they going?
We don't know. I mean, that's one of the, it's really hard to track sharks because they're underwater. You know, with something like zebra, you can sit and in the savannah and you can look at them over a long period of time and follow individuals. It's very harsh to do that on scuba. So we have this acoustic technology, which is great. You can get big long-term studies. However, if they're not in an area of where the receivers are, you can't really tell exactly where they are. So it's something that we want to look at in further down the line, but maybe the use of satellite telemetry. But the problem with the satellite telemetry is it doesn't tend to last as long. You can't put solar panels, it only lasts about a year. So the initial investigations were using acoustic telemetry.
Well, if the sharks are basically leaving their home and going out into the open ocean, is there a cost to that or a risk to the sharks?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a cost to the sharks, but also the ecosystem itself. As we said, that these are really important for the ecology of reefs. They bring in important nutrients. They also act as there's the landscape of fear. So little fish will hide and they won't damage the reef too much. So they're really important for the ecosystem. But for the conservation and management of sharks, they're really important. If they're moving around more, previous work that's been done with this species by my colleagues has found the more they move, the more they're likely to encounter illegal and unregulated fisheries. So as you probably know, there's been quite a lot of illegal takes of sharks, and they're causing massive, it's one of the major causes for the declines of coral reef sharks and reef across the world. So if they're moving around and staying away from the reefs, there's a good chance they're more likely to get taken by fishers.
Are the sharks showing up in other places where the water's not so warm?
Yeah, so I mean, what we did see, and this is one of the kind of the positives of this study, is that there are some areas where the sharks are leaving, but there are certain areas where they seem to be spending more time. So we're not sure whether this is because those reefs are, say, less warm, but it's potentially because they're not as impacted by these stress events. So certain reefs, what we found was that they overlap with areas of islands which where rats have been eradicated from these systems, and there's huge bird colonies there. In these islands where there's no rats, all the birds and the seabirds that live there, all that guano that comes in and makes for a real stable reef environment. So you get lots of fish there, so there might be lots of prey. So these sharks are probably leaving those areas potentially and spending more time in coral reefs which are a bit more stable.
What would happen to the abandoned reefs that they left if they never come back?
It's not that they're leaving completely, they're just spending less time there. But because of that, they may get taken over by certain other fish, so that may be more predatory to the coral reefs themselves. They're going to bring less nutrients. So overall, this is kind of, everything works in a balance. And without these sharks' presence and with these bleaching events, it's likely that these reefs will be damaged and they'll lose their flora and fauna that live there completely.
Dr. Williamson, thank you so much for your time.
No worries. Thank you very much.
Dr. Michael Williamson is a research scientist at the Zoological Society of London. I'm Bob McDonald, and you're listening to Quirks and Quarks on CBC Radio 1 and streaming live on the CBC News app. Just go to the Local tab and press play wherever you are. Coming up later in the program, Canadian astronaut Roberta Bondar takes a bird's-eye view of migration in a new book.
I understood that there was that art was kind of a way for me to be creative and express myself. And science was a way to diminish my fear factor and let me understand how things work. I felt that in this project, I wanted to intrigue people so they would be engaged in the book. Because I firmly believe if you love something, you want to protect it.
At the center of our galaxy is a supermassive black hole with a mass of more than 4 million suns. But very little is known about this incredible object. It's a long way away and obscured by the dust and stars around it. But thanks to recent observations collected by the Event Horizon Telescope, Dr. Ihan Wang has evidence that may shed light on the origin of the supermassive black hole known as Sagittarius A star. It seems it could have been formed by a merger of two smaller supermassive black holes, something like 10 billion years ago, when our galaxy was relatively young. Dr. Wang is a postdoctoral fellow at the Nevada Center for Astrophysics at the University of Nevada. Hello and welcome to our program.
Hi, hello.
First of all, how do we normally think of how supermassive black holes form at the centers of galaxies?
The typical theory would be like the supermassive black holes are formed from like a merger of smaller mass black holes. Some people also propose that those supermassive black holes are formed directly from dark matter at a very early stage of our universe. And some other theories also propose that we have like a very small mass black hole to begin with. Then those small black holes start to create material around it. And it's from those accretion process, the mass of the supermassive black hole can increase and become a supermassive black hole.
Oh, I see. So either lots of black holes or a few of them getting together to form a bigger one, or the black hole forming out of dark matter that's around the galaxy as it's forming, or just sucking up material that's within the galaxy itself. Is that the idea?
Yeah, correct.
Well, what evidence led you to believe that the supermassive black hole in our galaxy came from a merger of two black holes?
It comes from like a very special spin measurement from the Event Horizon Telescope. If we believe that a supermassive black hole is from an accretion process, then we would either predict a very high spin magnitude with very low spin misalignment, or a very low spin magnitude but with relatively large misalignment. But for the measurement from the event horizon test, they predict that the spin of the Sirtorian star is very high and with a very large misalignment with respect to the galactic plane.
So you're looking at the spin of the black hole itself, how quickly it's spinning around.
Yeah, correct.
And you're saying it's too fast?
It's too fast with a very large angle with respect to the galactic plane. And this cannot be predicted by the accretion theory.
You say large angle, you mean it's not in line with the galaxy?
Yeah, it is not aligned with the galaxy plane. So it is lying on the galactic plane, not perpendicular to the galactic plane.
Oh, I see. Yeah, the galaxy is very flat like a pizza, so this would be like in the center of the pizza, but it's angled a bit. How much of an angle is it off?
Between 30 to 90, it's a large angle.
Wow, 30 to 90 degrees, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So what does this tell you then about how the black hole might have formed?
If we assume that the Sagittarius A star is formed from accretion process, and in our community, we have like a two different accretion model. The first accretion model, we call it a coherent accretion model, means that all the material sucked by the supermassive black hole will have like the same direction of the angular momentum. So the black hole will spin faster and faster. But however, the spin of the supermassive black hole is aligned with a Milky Way. And the second accretion model in our community, we call the chaotic accretion model, which means that the material sucked by the supermassive black hole comes from all kinds of directions. So this will end up with a slow spinning supermassive black hole, but the direction can be in any direction. However, the spin measured by even Horizon Telescope is like high spinning and a large misalignment. So none of those accretion models can explain the measured spin of the Sirtorian A star.
Now, when you say accretion, that's the material that's swirling around the black hole before it falls in, which forms a disk around it, correct?
Yeah, you are right.
And so if that's aligned with the galaxy, the black hole formed from the galaxy, if it's off, like you say, 90 degrees, then it must have come from somewhere else.
Yeah, you are correct.
All right. So where then would the other black hole have come from?
Oh, it comes from another galaxy, like 10 billion years ago. Recently, we found some evidence about a galaxy merger, like our Milky Way merged with another small galaxy, like 10 billion years ago. And at the center of the other galaxy, we have another supermassive black hole.
Wow. So we had a galactic collision there. Our galaxy ran into another one.
Yeah. Our Milky Way collided with another small galaxy, like 10 billion years ago.
Boy. So how big would the black hole in the other galaxy have been to knock our black hole over by as much as 90 degrees?
It is like a 4 times smaller than our own galaxy.
4 times smaller, but still, that's still pretty big.
Yeah, it's pretty big. So we call it a major merger.
Only a billion suns in massive. Have you seen evidence elsewhere in the universe of this kind of merger of black holes taking place?
Not yet. And there are a big community in our astronomy to looking for the gravitational wave from supermassive black hole binaries. And the gravitational wave detector is like a space bomb gravitational detector that is going to operate in 2030s. So we will see a lot of events like in 5 or 10 years, but we haven't seen any events directly from the gravitational wave yet.
We have another galaxy that's heading our way, Andromeda, which is gigantic. I mean, it's even bigger than our Milky Way. Could this happen again?
It definitely will happen. We will collide with another massive galaxies in the future.
In a few billion years from now?
Billions of years from now. So we don't need to worry about
it. Okay, but when it does happen, it'll be quite an event.
Yeah. It's like a bigger merger event.
Dr. Wang, thank you so much for your time.
Okay, thank you so much.
Dr. Ihan Wang is a postdoctoral fellow at the Nevada Center for Astrophysics at the University of Nevada.
Have a good flight, safe landing.
3, 2, 1, 0, and liftoff of the Space Shuttle Discovery and the first International Microgravity Laboratory.
32 years ago, Dr. Roberta Bondar flew as Canada's first female astronaut on the space shuttle Discovery. She became one of the relatively few people, especially at that time, who has had the chance to see the Earth from space. That gave her a rare perspective on our planet. After her career as an astronaut, Dr. Bondar trained in nature photography. And that, along with her training as a pilot, meant that she got two more distinctive perspectives on the planet. She's combined those perspectives in a new book that looks at two unique species and their place, or places, on Earth. And she's hoping seeing this through her eyes will give us all a bit of a perspective on nature and its fragility. The book is called Space for Birds: Patterns and Parallels of Beauty in Flight. Dr. Bondar, welcome back to Quirks and Quarks.
Yes, thank you.
Now, before we get to your book, you trained first as a physician, a neurologist, then as an astronaut. What led you from that to yet another career as a wildlife photographer?
Well, I've been always interested in flight. I think that's obvious. But when I was growing up, I was really interested in birds when I was a little girl. And I couldn't fly, be a pilot in the military or anything, because women weren't allowed. So I got my license by myself when I was 17 or 18. And I always had this huge interest in birds, but I had to have a plane around me to fly. And then when I got into space, being able to float around, pretend I was flying like a bird was quite exhilarating. And then when I got back, I started doing a lot of landscape photography, especially of the national parks. And I felt there was something that I wanted to add to the landscapes all the time. And it was birds. I missed their sounds and song when I was in flight. And it actually gave me a kind of an unfortunate insight into what the world would look like if there was no bird to sing. So that's really how it came full circle.
Well, let's start with the inspiration for this book, that idea of perspectives, starting with the perspective you got from space.
It's true that we seem to be bowled over with seeing the Earth from space. A lot of it has to do with the fact it's the first time we've ever seen the planet as a planet. Down here, we kind of look around and we know it is because we've read about it, but it's that three-dimensional, real-time, kind of visceral feeling that we get when we actually see the Earth and see the blacks around. William Shatner talked about the thin blue line of the atmosphere and how gobsmacked he was to be able to see that. So I think that's probably the most visceral moment, except for maybe tossing your cookies once in a while in the first couple of days.
Well, I mean, when did you connect what you were seeing from space with bird flight?
Apart from actually pretending I was a bird floating around the planet a little bit faster than birds fly, it was basically coming back. And one of the things that I felt when I was in space, I really want to get down there and explore this place. It's a matter of pressing forward to then use that view to come down to the surface and see what's actually here that's been making up those patterns.
You focus on two species of migratory bird in the book. What was it about the idea of migration that you wanted to illustrate?
Migration is about habitat protection, again, referencing the natural world and what birds need to be able to do these incredible voyages that they do. I mean, if you look at the whooping crane, it's one of the two species to go twice a year, 4,200 kilometers. And one way, it's actually when one of the eggs has grown into a chick or a colt, and they're not a year old, they're not even 8 months old, and they're having to fly this 4,200 kilometers all the way down to Texas. So it's that kind of heroic things that they do, and to be very intrigued about trying to get people's attention focused on the habitats that they need all the way down.
So it's not about just where they start and where they end up, but everything in between.
Absolutely, Bob. It's the amazing part of nature. I mean, even monarch butterflies, I could have done a book on them too. It's the idea that our planet has so many special things and it's used by life forms in different ways. I used to really love looking at trees a lot, and then I realized the trees don't really move very far. But birds take me to places I perhaps wouldn't have thought of going. They certainly on this project have taken me to places that I wouldn't have thought about as a destination. and I wouldn't have thought about looking at what challenges that particular environment is facing, because of most of it would be human impact, whether it's climate change related or human construct.
Well, your book is a very beautiful book with wonderful color images, both from space and from the ground of the birds. And there are two birds that you focus on. One you mention is the whooping crane. The other you write about is the lesser flamingo. Let's start with the flamingo. What story did you want to tell about that species?
The lesser flamingo is an Eastern Hemisphere bird that's near threatened, whereas the whooping crane is a Western Hemisphere bird and it's endangered. The two birds also differ in respect to their behavior. The whooping crane is much more solitary, but the lesser flamingo has this tremendous colony kind of attitude. They kind of like a whole brain and all these hundreds and sometimes thousands of flamingos flocking together. So they have this flock behavior. They decide who's going to have a chick, etc. So their social structure is so different. And they're such a beautiful bird, and they have a very interesting way of getting nutrition into themselves. And people mistake them all the time for a greater flamingo. They have to eat bacteria. Can you imagine? They have to eat all day long to get enough bacteria to make themselves pink. So the flamingo and the whooping crane had an attractive feature besides being representative of two hemispheres that we fly over in space. They also are big enough to be seen from the air. And one of the big parts of my project was for me to do aerial photography to look at the relationships between land and water, for example. Because we see patterns from space that are quite abstract and very beautiful. From the air, there are different types of patterns. They look differently. Lesser flamingos the same way. They go up and down the Rift Valley, and they may even go to Asia or up to the western part of Africa or South Africa. So they'd be able to see these birds from the air and photograph them in a way that's artistic, that would draw people into an image. And then after that, they would ask questions, and the questions by and large are answered through science.
Where did you go to take your pictures of the flamingos?
I started out in Kenya. I had the opportunity. I was doing a project, doing some workshops for young women over there. And I went to this one national refuge called Lake Bogoria in Kenya. And there are flamingos all along the coast, but they're hard to see unless you're in the air. Or if they're also very skitterish, and you don't want to get too close to them to scare them anyway, because it takes a lot of energy for them to fly. And of course, they have to eat a lot more bacteria because of it. Because although there are a lot more of them than there are whooping cranes, the lesser flamingo is more challenged because of potential habitat changes in their nesting area, which is in Tanzania. So I went to Tanzania and photographed some of these exquisite creatures. And It was really an eye-opener. The type of temperatures that they need, so different from the whooping crane, which is, you know, up in the getting close to the Arctic, not quite in the Arctic, in the Northwest Territories. So different. Habitats so different, but the same kind of challenges that they're facing.
I've had the privilege of visiting Tanzania, and I've seen flamingos there at Lake Manyara and Ngorongoro Crater. And they make a funny noise when they're all in a group like that. I can only describe it as boiling rubber. They make this like weird sound that I didn't expect.
You're good at that.
Such beautiful
birds. You're good at that, Bob.
Okay, so you got the pictures on the ground and aerial photography, but what about the pictures from space of these same habitats?
In order to get this broader view, I wanted to do three things with space images. One, I wanted to remind people we're on a planet. So any image I wanted, I needed to have the edge of the Earth and the blackness of space in them. The second thing is that I wanted to be able to have images that would go across the corridor in which these birds fly, because even though we're 300 kilometers up, these migratory pathways are so big, you can't see them and you can't capture them in one photograph. And then the third thing, I wanted to have people make the connection that you can't see these things from space, you can't see life, and that it should become a precious commodity for people, that if you get far enough back and you don't see life anymore, that if this happens, then none of us will exist. We won't have all these wonderful things that the natural environment provides to us. So,
but you're not an astronaut. You're not an astronaut now. So what did you do? Phone up the space station and say, hey, could you folks take a picture of Africa next time you pass over?
Pretty much. What I did was I talked to NASA, and because it, you know, once an astronaut, always an astronaut in that sense. It's certainly not actively flying. And so I went to the people of the Earth Observation because they knew that before my flight, in those days it was film people were using, and I spent hours and hours and hours that were way outside of my training schedule to look at every aspect of the Earth on every kind of sheet of film that I could get hold of. And I would give myself challenges about what this thing was that was upside down, or was it obliquely, and try to get used to these environments before I got into space. So the Earth Ops people knew that I had this penchant for looking at the planet, and certainly they knew my history and photography. I told them about this project, and they thought I should apply to be principal investigator on migratory birds, which I did. And because of that, I was able to send them coordinates. So I gave them very specific things: cloud cover, the angle I wanted the camera at, the area over the world that I wanted at, the size of film, the size of lens that I wanted to use. And we had stopover areas, we had nesting areas, we had non-breeding seasonal areas. So NASA was very, very helpful, and they would send us all these images and we would go through them, and I'd pick out the ones that I felt told the story the best. So it turns out in the book, it's not even a 1% of the images from space that the astronauts had either taken for this project or that were in the archives already resident NASA.
Boy. Well, take me through some of those pictures, like the space-based ones, because some are really distinctive and even strange-looking.
Well, for sure, the ones that were in the whooping crane air, if I can just get that particular bird, they were very difficult to get because neither the space station nor the space shuttle goes as far north as the breeding area, right? It really only goes to about maybe Baker Lake, which is the geographic center of Canada, but it's not much beyond that. So to get a shot of Lake Clair, I had to go back in time to really earlier shuttle missions to get these images of Lake Clair in the southern part. So I had to try to get the areas that I knew the whooping cranes like to be in. So some of them, there's one that's over the Midwest United States, which is a huge agricultural area. And there are like two areas where the whooping cranes can land that are not in this harvested field. So they tend to go to these very small national wildlife refuges or wildlife management areas. And then the coastline, of course, of the Gulf of Mexico was a wonderful part of that. When I looked over at the lesser flamingo, I was not able to get to some of these sites. First of all, COVID happened and I couldn't get to Namibia, although I had the trip already planned and booked. And then the other parts of Western Africa. So I ended up with space images to really look at some of these areas. So again, NASA was able to help me get exactly what I needed, including a lovely shot of the continent of Africa, looking from south to South Africa north. So some of these images are very powerful because they have the limb of the Earth in, and they are almost like a page out of a geography book.
Well, the pictures that you got of North America with the whooping crane, particularly of northern Alberta, there were these pothole lakes. They really look strange.
Yes, they do. There's an area in North America called the Prairie Pothole Region, and it is the area that really met with a lot of changes because of agriculture and because of water use and water diversion. There's a lot of lakes, for example, Lake Diefenbaker, because of the dams, it looks like the head of a hammerhead shark. There's Last Mountain Lake, which is a very thin, skinny-looking lake from space, but it's one of the biggest wildlife management areas in the prairies where the whooping cranes go through, and lots of other migratory birds. So yes, from space you get a different certainly a different view, but it really makes it fascinating and makes it fascinating to say, well, what's down there? What, you know, where's my house? So I think people become quite engaged when there's some kind of a personal connection.
Mm-hmm. But you got pothole lakes in Alberta for the whooping crane. In Africa with the flamingos, you're capturing a very distinctive environment, the salt lakes.
Yes, the East African Rift Valley, so amazing. And to think that these bacteria that the lesser flamingo eat are so dependent on water use is amazing. If the column of water gets too diluted because of rains, or if it is not diluted enough, these bacteria won't grow because they're in algae. And it's hard because then the flamingos have to move on to another lake. So these lakes are in a constant state of change, especially Lake Natron, which is the southern end that I feature in the book, as you mentioned, in Tanzania. It is an extraordinary lake, and there's images there that haven't been taken since the early 2000s that I have in the exhibition that goes with the book, and they are extraordinary images of a lot of these algae and cyanobacteria growing in large, large masses, enough to see them from space.
Well, your book is not just about conservation. The photos are incredible, beautiful. And you write in many of your captions about the composition you were trying to capture. So tell me about the artistic side of the project.
Yes, I'm a fan of Leonardo da Vinci. And there's somebody that had science defined in a different way because it was a different era. But back in the day, he was really incorporating art and science in a way that intrigued people. And I just feel, I grew up in a family where my mom and my sister were very artistic. My mom wrote poetry, as did my sister. My sister wrote books. And my dad was very technical and loved photography. I understood that that art was kind of a way for me to be creative and express myself and to look into things differently. And science was a way to diminish my fear factor and let me understand how things work. I felt that in this project, I wanted to intrigue people so they would be engaged in the book, because I firmly believe if you love something, you want to protect it. And my background as a physician is I'm a specialist in neurology, but subspecialized in neuro-ophthalmology, which is how we see and view the world around us. So I kind of understand what people will see when they look at something, what the neuronal system of the brain really does, like what the retina really grabs, like color versus and size and texture, etc. So all these elements that are part of art, how do I use that in a meaningful way to try to bring people in? So in the helicopter, when I'm trying to create these canvases, it's about using my experience as a pilot to tell the helicopter pilot where I want him to bank, where I want him to turn around. I want him to go 15 degrees to the east or whatever. And I can communicate that because of the experience I've had and the credibility I still have with these pilots. I wanted to do that to show my respect for the natural world of the planet and really respect for my family's helping me with my value system and for trying to look at the world in an ethical way and trying to bring people into a calmer view, but a more responsible view of what we have on the planet that we need to really think about. And I felt combining art and science would be a very good way of doing that.
Well, your new perspective on the planet is going to be appreciated. Thank you so much for giving us your time, and thank you for the book.
Well, thank you very much, and best with your book too.
Dr. Roberta Bondar is a neurologist, Canada's first female astronaut, a wildlife photographer, and the author of the new book, Space for Birds, Patterns and Parallels of Beauty and Flight. And that's it for Quirks and Quarks this week. If you'd like to get in touch with us, our email is quirks@cbc.ca, or just go to the contact link on our webpage at cbc.ca/quirks, where you can read my latest blog or listen to our audio archives. You can also follow our podcast, get us on SiriusXM, or download the CBC Listen app. It's free from the App Store or Google Play. Quirks and Quarks is produced by Rosie Fernandez, Amanda Buckowitz, and Sonia Biting. Our senior producer is Jim Lebbins. I'm Bob McDonald. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.